The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Weekly Extra saying, chin up, English clubs, at least you're not Schalke. Yes, it's another week of Champions League fun and games. We discuss Man United, the worst performance in Greece since Danny Dyer got cast in the remake, and the worst Rio performance this side of, well, let's wait for this summer, shall we? We salute Chelsea too for scoring a goal. Get news from the rest of Europe. Salivate over Juve Milan, PSG Lorem, and the Madrid derby. And we talk about the League Cup. Will the Black Cats be City's bête noire? All that plus post-tweets and the Premier League weekend. Can English sides at least beat each other? That's in today's Football Weekly Extra. Off we go then. And when I say we, I mean Amy Lawrence.
Hi, Jimbo.
Nice to see you.
Nice to be here.
Barry Glendening.
Hello.
You're looking pensive, Barry. Pensive.
We're in a different studio to usual. It's
exactly.
Small and cramped, and I feel torn between just soldiering on or throwing a hissy fit and demanding we go back to our proper big studio.
Yeah, it's not too late to throw that. Let's just see how it plays out. Ian McIntosh, you won't be throwing any hissy fits.
Absolutely
not.
When
was the last time you had a tantrum, Ian?
A tantrum?
Mm.
Oh, God, I don't remember. I don't think I've ever had one. I'm a lake
Warren.
Of placidity.
At least he turned up today. Let's just be grateful for that.
Well, the jury's still out on that one. But, hey, speaking of people who didn't turn up, Man United, eh? Man United. One shot in the 88th, or was it 89th minute, away to Olympiacos. Who saw this one coming, Amy?
Well, not David Moyes, eh? In fact, of all the many things that you can analyse about that evening, I thought that his press conference again was something where you just, it's a bit like seeing a school play and there's a kid up there who's forgotten their lines or getting it wrong and you're sort of shifting a bit uncomfortably in your seat. It just doesn't feel quite right.
Painful to watch, huh?
A little bit, yes.
Man United, they weren't in the zone, but we know now why, because they were all in Robin van Persie's.
Oh, yes, impinging on his territory, muscling in on his space that he wanted.
That's not very total football, is it? I mean, coming from a Dutchman, you'd like to think that they're comfortable in all zones.
It's a bit like the studio that we're in. This isn't our natural zone because you know, there's problems in the other one. And you can hear that already we're not comfortable with it. Anyway, now, Olympiacos have already beaten Dortmund, Arsenal twice, Benfica and Man United at home in the recent season. So, yeah, was Moyes right to be cautious going there, Ian?
To a certain extent, and given their form of late, yeah, you didn't want to go absolutely kamikaze. But we're still dealing with a team which is barely second tier in Europe. It's made up of sort of nomadic players from French second divisions and lower mid-table German sides. And, yeah, it's... They were the weakest team in the 16. They were the team that Manchester United really wanted. And I think had it been 2-0 and it was just freakish good fortune with barrel loads of missed chances, then maybe people could accept it. But it was the complete lack of fight, of any kind of willingness to do anything. People weren't making runs. People weren't tracking back. The midfield was barely there. The number of times Olympiacos just cut straight down the centre. It was actually fortunate Vidic pulled in quite a number of good tackles because it could have been far worse. But
all right, so
there were just no positives.
This then is the lowest point of Moyes' reign at Old Trafford.
I'd say that, but I've said that about three or four times this season.
So far.
Every time his bum
so
hits the floorboards creak, give way and he crashes down a new level. Where's it going to stop?
I don't know. Barry, where is it going to stop?
Well, there's a suggestion today that he's been given 12 games to save his job.
Really? Why 12?
I don't know.
Where does that take us up to?
Well, it depends, really, doesn't it?
I mean, 11 of those in the Premier League.
Maybe he's allowed Pickwich 12, and it might
12
like
would be
five
the rest
of them
the
might
season,
be next
surely.
Season.
Well, you've got 11 games left in the Premier League campaign, and arguably one in the Champions League, so that would make you 12 games. So he's got the rest of the season to save his job, which is less dramatic. The Man United turnaround, the comeback win at Old Trafford when they play that, can you see that happening, Amy?
I think it's possible because, as Ian just pointed out...
It is possible.
Out,
can you
Olympiacos
see it happening?
Thank you. But Olympiacos are not the strongest of the available teams that United could have faced, let's be honest. And I think most of us thought when we looked at the draw when it came out a little while ago, I don't recall ever seeing such a massive chasm between the seeds and the runners-up. It seemed very, very brutal this particular year. Mm. And with that in mind, you were, you know, right to expect all the group winners to probably go through in the end. And from that point of view, I think if Man United can get an early goal and the supporters start to try and create one of those famous Old Trafford nights, then I don't think Olympiacos are necessarily experienced enough or of the quality to sort to handle it if United can click. And bearing in mind that they have still got, Van Persie, you know, can find his shooting boots if Rooney is having a good game, etc. They have got goals in them, but there just does seem to be this feeling that there is obviously a bigger picture for United. It's not, is it really about this tie against Olympiacos?
Well, it kind of is, because if they don't win this one by three goals, that's the last Champions League they're going to be seeing for, well, a very long
time.
But
if they do come through, do we think that they're going to probably come through against who they might face in the next round?
Well, that's another question, of course.
I think looking at the performances of all the other teams,
But they might draw a Premier League side. Is that possible?
Well, they've all got to get through as well, haven't they? Yeah. I mean, Chelsea obviously have the best chance, but the others still look like tall orders.
Of course, Old Trafford's such a difficult place to go to and get a result for Olympiacos, as we've seen with West Brom's visit there this year, Newcastle's visit there this year, a repeat to fade Swansea's visit there this year, Sunderland's visit there this year.
David Moyes' natural sort of default tactic is caution, fairly extreme caution, and Roberto Mancini says the same, and we saw he abandoned that last night with hilarious consequences. But it'll be interesting to see what team Moyes picks now that he has to go for it, and a situation in which I suspect he won't be particularly comfortable. But his team selection the other night was strange, to say the least, and I think it would have been better to go with a more adventurous lineup. And then if they lost, at least they'd have lost and gone down in flames, so to speak, rather than just putting in this really awful performance where they look like a mid to bottom of the table Premier League side. And
where are they exactly at the moment? Mid-to-bottom.
They're not quite that bad yet. No, they're getting there.
But David Moyes is naturally cautious. Is his Everton team used to come up with some results? Would his Everton side had his Everton side with him in charge from, say, a year ago, been transported through the medium of time travel to the Piraeus Stadium the other night, would they have had this result, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's a lot of revisionism about Moyes and Everton and turning Manchester United into Everton, but it's not true. It's Bobbins. Everton were good. There were the countless times last season when Everton were actually playing good football. I don't know. There have been so many people saying, well, has he been overwhelmed by the burden of responsibility? Is he just reverting to base and trying to make everything safe and then look to build on from there? And that perhaps this desperately trying to avoid humiliation has become a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Only Moyes knows, really. But it's really, there are no bright spots. There's no positives apart from one, I should say. If you've read a selection of the papers today, you'll know that they're a very similar story in all of them, that it's not all bad news for Manchester United, because David Moyes has revolutionised the scouting network at Manchester United with whiteboards and coloured marker pens, and also a database that allows him to list players in order of position anywhere in Europe.
Right, where would he get his hands on such an advanced tool?
It does sound a bit like a Football Manager game, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed. Amy?
I think the role of Ferguson is an interesting one, and I know that, you know, there was a whole period of time where every time Ferguson's face appeared on the TV, there was lots of debate and lots of ominous stuff going on. But what I'd like to know, which I'm never going to find out, but as a director, as he is now, most clubs would have a board meeting most weeks where they kind of chit-chat about how things are going and so on. And does Ferguson go to these meetings? If so, you know, you can imagine, obviously, on matters football, his authority carries rather a lot more weight than anyone else that might be in those board meetings. And it's a tricky situation, because he must have some strong views about how David Moyes is faring. And is that being put across? Is that compromised by the fact that he was the kingmaker in the first place? It's tricky, isn't it?
Very difficult.
It seems increasingly extraordinary that Manchester United did appoint this manager with no match or tournament winning experience when Jose Mourinho was available and managers with better pedigree are available. And the row this week seems to have been, you know, who has to take responsibility, the players or the manager or the owners? But there's a lot of collective responsibility, I think.
Blame everyone.
There was an interesting tweet from Joey Barton during the week in which he suggested there's a rumour going around that Nemanja Vidic has completely fallen out with the hierarchy there over the way his contract was handled and now doesn't even change in the same dressing room as the rest of the team.
Really?
Yeah. And
does he change in the corridor?
I don't know. Maybe he changes in his car.
That's not unheard of in the Premier League of late.
Really?
Yeah, there were lots of rumours about QPR and the cliques in the dressing room so bad that people were refusing to eat with the rest of the squad and taking packed lunches and just eating them sadly in the car park on their own.
Sounds like The Guardian or something. That's terrible. What do you, this return match with the Olympiacos, is that going to be the last Champions League football United see for at least 19 months?
Possibly even more. Once you're out, it's a lot harder to get back in because every season you have four teams earning considerably more money than you. You have to pay premiums on wages, not just to attract new players, but to keep existing players because everyone wants to be in the Champions League. Mm. But let's not write it off yet. There is direct precedent for this kind of situation with Liverpool in the early 90s when Souness took over and had a very wobbly start much earlier in the season, but they lost 2-0 away at Auxerre and then came back. No one gave them a chance at Anfield, but they won 3-0, sort of powered on by the fans and this, what we were talking about earlier, this almost sense of entitlement that this is a team that should do comebacks, that should do great European nights.
Right.
And I do remember Graham Souness saying, this is a result that'll kickstart our season. It didn't.
Right.
But, you know, it has happened before.
Yeah.
There is hope.
Right.
And I know how much Manchester United fans like to look to Liverpool for hope.
To what extent, though, should we paint this? Because doing a little bit of research for the paper review, which will be up on Friday on the Guardian's website, I noticed that the rest of Europe is having a laugh, quite frankly, at the crumbling empire of the Premier League. The French in particular, tittering away. To what extent should we treat these as individual cases, or to what extent should we talk about a general malaise of top Premier League sides on the continent?
I think there's been a malaise for longer than just this season. I mean, ever since the 50% tax rate came in and a number of top players scarpered to Ronaldo, Alonso, people
like
that.
Is that because of taxes?
Alonso, according to no less an authority than Jonathan Wilson.
Really?
Alonso was quite upset about the tax,
right? I thought players always had their net income ring-fenced so that any extra tax burdens were supported by the club.
I think some do, but there are a number of players who had their tax revenues protected by things like investing in British films in elaborate schemes and offshore things. Keith Gillespie's book, I'm halfway through actually,
right.
Makes fascinating reading for things like that. But the 50% tax rate was a burden on and a blocker on bringing in top-class
opponents. I've not heard that one before. That's fascinating.
Really?
Yeah, interesting.
Wasn't it a story that when Andre Arshavin signed for Arsenal, he thought the wages he was being quoted were netto, but apparently they were grosso, and he was only earning half as much as he thought and was severely disgruntled, a fact which was reflected in many of his performances.
Well, right.
And then you have other areas like Turkey, where I think the tax rate's only
about
12%.
Perhaps that's why Mesut Özil's become so depressed of late.
Yeah. Similar mistake.
Yeah.
Talking about this, is it a part of a general malaise thing?
General malaise.
I think, you know, if you look at it, practically, Man United going through a hard time, so that's not massively surprising. Arsenal playing against Bayern Munich team in this round where they've been going out in the last few years, that's not massively surprising. Chelsea have every chance of going through, and Man City really were probably a little bit unfortunate to draw Barcelona. So it's not. I think you can make a reason.
So you can put it down to basically
big
Premier League clubs playing foreign sides who are better than them. Barcelona and Bayern Munich.
That kind of sums it up.
Not in any way like an indication that they're not as good. Interesting.
But during the summer, there was a sort of a constant theme that there were these big players being linked with Premier League clubs and then going elsewhere. And
right.
That seems set to continue. Like, a lot of them are obviously having their heads turned by certain clubs in Ligue 1, like Monaco and PSG, who can just offer money that English clubs can't. With the possible exception of City,
right?
But even Chelsea, City.
Well, Chelsea are.
What about United?
Chelsea seem to be
300,000 to.
Chelsea seem to be attempting at least to fit in with financial fair play, whereas certain other teams aren't.
Yeah, indeed so.
Monaco, obviously, having the ability to pay players without any tax at all.
Yeah.
But you have to live in Monaco, then.
Yeah, I could put up with that.
Could you?
Yeah.
Have you ever been there?
I'm from Essex.
Amy wouldn't like to live there. I think I could stomach it for a bit. You could just live over the border, couldn't
exactly.
you?
Exactly. If you're going
to, or do, there, does that affect your tax things?
I'd still be fine with Monaco.
Yeah, yeah. You'd be all right.
It seems nice and sunny.
It is sunny.
I could have a little boat. It'd be lovely.
Yeah, on the boat.
Yeah, yeah. You're all welcome. I'll have a party.
Lovely. Now, more good news for Man United. They've got the weekend off. Because they were going to be facing the derby with Man City. That would have been interesting. That would have been a great game to follow up this Olympiacos debacle. But they don't have that because Man City are playing in the League Cup final, Barry, against Sunderland.
Mm.
Mm. There's a fantastic article by Jonathan Wilson all about Sunderland's last Wembley final.
Yeah, I read that. It's very entertaining and well worth looking out or digging out. He seems quite worried that Sunderland might win. And he doesn't seem quite sure that would be a good thing for him. But I don't think he has much to worry about, to be honest. So
you don't, because they have this terrific record against Man City.
They do, yeah. It's remarkable. They've beaten them four seasons in a row at home in the league. Sunderland's record in cup finals since the one they won in 1973, the FA Cup final, has been awful. They haven't been in many and they've lost them all. And I'm not confident at all, particularly given how they played last week against Arsenal. They were just terrible. If they play like that again, they'll get slaughtered.
Wasn't that a classic pre-cup final?
I suppose it probably was, yeah. But, I mean, Ian was saying that the window for Man City getting caught out in cup finals by lowlier opposition has probably closed now.
With Wigan last year.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Here's a couple of things that might suggest Sunderland have a chance. One, Man City are having a bit of a struggle at the moment. They failed to score in three of their last five games. Now, Aguero's due to be back, but he'll be coming back from a lengthy absence, so who knows if he'll hit the ground running. Here's my other one. Pantelimon's going to be in goal. Yeah, for Man City, because he's their cup goalie.
Yeah, I think the Aguero factor just might weigh a little bit too heavily, though.
Hmm. All right, well, they beat Man U on the way. They beat Chelsea in the quarterfinals, Sunderland did, Southampton. Well, and MK Dons as well. So, hey, you know, it's very much their year, Barry, surely. Sunderland's.
Is it?
Yeah. No? You beat Man United in the semis. You beat Chelsea in the quarterfinal.
Look, it's a cup final. They have a chance. But if you're going to try and get me to predict a Sunderland win, I don't think they will win.
Right.
I obviously hope they do. And
yes.
Just even acquitting themselves well would do me. But I can't see beyond a Man City win.
Ben Producer's so confident that Sunderland are going to produce a historic result on Sunday that he's booked you, Jonathan Wilson, and Sunderland Football's Kevin Kilbane for Monday's show. Tell you what, they better win, otherwise it's going to be a very flat performance, that one. So then,
bring your joke book, Jimbo.
Yeah. Is anyone going?
Yeah, I am.
I'll be there. Barry.
Are you going to be there as well? Together?
No.
Where are you going to be sat? Here?
Well, you see, I don't go to many Sunderland games, so I didn't want to take a ticket from a proper fan. So I've decided to just take a bullet and tolerate or sort of run the corporate hospitality gauntlet.
All right, with who? Which corporation gets the...
I'd rather not today. That's what they want me to do.
Ian?
I'll be in the press box attempting to lift the mood of Jonathan Wilson, who will probably take this to heart if it doesn't go well. Mind you, he'll probably take it to heart if it does go well.
Yeah.
But either way, it's going to be a very emotional day for him. He needs his friends around him.
All right, excellent stuff. Excellent.
We might meet you afterwards for a pint.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
Great. Well, that's it for part one, listeners. Still to come, all sorts of other things, starting with Chelsea after this. Right, Galatasaray, Chelsea. Roberto Mancini is a very helpful man. He helped Mourinho win a triple, and in turn he helped his Chelsea team score a goal here with his with his ill-advised tactics at the beginning, Ian. Would you explain to Thicky Slimy?
Yeah, I mean, just before the game, there was a sort of exchange through the press of Mancini, first of all, claiming that Mourinho had won the treble, basically, because Mancini had built that team. Mourinho had responded by saying, five-a-side team, more like, because that's all the players I used in the final. Mm. And I think that must have rattled Mancini, because a manager we usually associate with being so defensive sent out what was essentially a 4-2-4, with the back four pushed right up to the halfway line, leaving acres of space.
So it was a mind game that backfired.
I think it might have been.
A mind game. I think it might have been.
But
this is when managers get inside each other's heads, Barry. It's a new thing.
Isn't it when managers say things and the press sort of really misinterpret them just to create a narrative?
No. It's a kind of more...
So it's really messing. He's like, messing got his fingers on his temples,
well,
twirling, going...
Well, Mancini was so upset by Mourinho's stinging rebuke that he cast caution to the wind and went with entirely the wrong setup. A fact which Chelsea should have made him pay for, but they gave him time to put it right.
Yeah, they should have done an awful lot better, because everyone knew how Chelsea were going to play. They were going to kind of keep it tight, they were going to be a bit deep, they were going to look to play on the counter, and suddenly they find all this space to loft balls at Andre Schürrle and Fernando Torres, and they should have scored more than the one they did, because after half an hour, Mancini, to his immense credit, realised it had all gone horribly wrong and rejigged the formation.
Right. Well, the second half was all about Galatasaray, wasn't it? They looked utterly in control. Isn't that a bit worrying for Chelsea? I mean, is this little horses theory true? If Galatasaray, with the right setup, can boss them around quite so effectively?
Obviously, you know, the game is poised, as some people would say. But I would still be highly surprised if Chelsea don't see it through in the second leg.
Right. Is it the only tie in the last 16 with any tension left in it?
I think there's a little bit of tension, like sort of a saggy tennis racket that's been sitting in the attic unused for... But, you know, the strings aren't broken. But,
right.
There's that much tension in the Arsenal-Bayern Munich game.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I'd put that more at Sam Allardyce's underpants.
Oh, God, my mind's eye.
Can I go now?
I thought you were going with the Barcelona-Man City. No?
No. I still don't think there's tension in Man United.
Tension
in Olympiacos, come on.
Oh, yeah, of course, sorry, yeah.
And Schalke have got all the momentum now.
what a goal.
Wasn't it?
What a goal by Huntelaar. All right, okay. Well, we could talk about Fulham-Chelsea, which is Chelsea's next fixture, or we could save that treat for later, and it is a bit of a treat, top event against bottom. Felix Magu in his home debut. Craven Cottage. I have a funny feeling that something surprising might happen there, because if anyone's got a Teflon brain, a brain impermeable to the Mourinho mind games, I reckon it's that Felix fella. Anyway, let's instead talk about other Champions League. Now, you mentioned Klaus-Jan Huntelaar's extraordinary goal to make it just the 6-1. Real Madrid absolutely tearing. Who are they? I think they're fourth right now in the Bundesliga, but top four German side apart. This calls, methinks, for a phone call to Sid Lowe. Oh, Sid. All right. That's right, listeners. Sid's too busy to talk to us. Amy, what you got?
Well, there was this... You were talking about mind games earlier, and there was that kind of intriguing situation where Mourinho got a little bit piqued by some material that he obviously thought was not being... recorded.
Yeah, he obviously thought that. Have you seen
emerging
the clip, actually?
Yes.
It's pretty obvious he's being filmed.
Yeah, well, I presume... I think he knew he was being filmed, but he thought the conversation was just sort of pre-interview chat that was going to be off the record. I can kind of understand that, but then when you have the absolutely preposterous situation where Jose Mourinho is lecturing a room full of professionals on ethics in a subsequent press conference.
Yeah, one in the eye for ethics, one might call. Yeah.
And, that's kind of funny. And he also, I mean, Mourinho has done well out of manipulating the media to his own ends throughout the course of his career, so, you know, it's hard to feel sympathy from when the shoe is on the other foot.
I just always assume I would always assume that whatever he says, he actually thinks the opposite. So when he complained loudly about this, I assume it's because that's exactly what he wanted. He said it in front of the cameras thinking, they may pick this up, and that's fine by me. And if he actually had been upset by it, he wouldn't have really made any comment about it.
That's an interesting psychology. I just think with Mourinho that it's so apparent that he pre-thinks almost everything that he wants to tell us. And I think he is the one of all managers, and I think a lot of them do try this, and it's a perfectly legitimate tactic, you know, especially coming into a post-match press conference when you quite might well be feeling a little bit emotional and heated by what's gone on. If you allow yourself to react to questions and you haven't thought them through, that's where you can sometimes probably find yourself getting into a bit of trouble you hadn't anticipated. But managers try quite hard to have a few thoughts in their head when they come in to meet the press or face a TV camera to deliberately take control of the situation.
Who else do you think is good at this?
Well, I mean, I think Alex Ferguson used to be good at this at times as well. But Mourinho is the master of this particular effect.
Mm.
And, I mean, there's plenty of stories where the question is almost irrelevant that comes from, you know, from the media, and the response is so obviously, here's my message.
Mm.
So for him to have been, if he was caught out, and unlike your theory, where he didn't expect that to come out on purpose, I think that will have been the thing that most got him, was that it was something that he hadn't actually prepared.
Ooh.
I hadn't considered the possibility that it could be a reverse sting, which I really, really like the sound of, some way of applying pressure to Abramovich to spend in the summer. But if it's not that, I've got a lot of sympathy for him. I mean, if he's in an area where there's lots of cameras and reporters lining up waiting for interviews, then there are going to be cameras going on and off as people get set up. So he wouldn't think anything suspicious of a man standing there with a camera. It might just be someone, you know, setting up his angles and getting his lighting ready.
The camera's kind of following him around. He's talking to the president of Hublot. I don't know if there's a Jaffa cake effect on this, but Hublot, the Swiss watch company. And he basically makes all these kind of fairly ill-advised comments about Samuel Eto'o. Well, he's actually about 4 years older, who knows, etc. Heavy hints and
but,
that.
But
and it's an unguarded moment in a situation which, you know, I think for respect for Eto'o, he should be guarded in. And I only assume that he decided that he'd just be a little bit cheeky. A little bit like, you remember his Shevchenko off-playing golf moment? Which wasn't necessarily on the record. When somebody asked him in the Stamford Bridge crowd, I think, where is Shevchenko? And he just mimed golf swing. And it was patently there for everyone to see, this little off the...
But I think we've all had moments where we've got like little snippets of tape on dictaphone of someone saying something that they probably shouldn't have said. And there's always a kind of trust between interviewer and interviewee that, you know, don't worry, that bit won't go in. I do think it's a massive breach of trust. If I was Mourinho, I'd be furious. Unless, of course, it's a reverse sting, in which case it's awesome.
Yeah. Awesome, all right.
But Steve Keane got in trouble in a similar fashion, except it wasn't a media professional that was taping him, it was some guys he'd met in a pub. And, yeah, that was an
Roy
expensive
Hodgson.
Evening out.
Yeah.
Roy Hodgson on the tube.
Yeah.
And it I believe it was actually a media professional, in that it was a former News of the World journalist who had spotted a way back into the game.
All right, was he dressed as a sheikh or anything like that?
That should have been the giveaway.
Yeah. Let's try Sid again after that interesting interlude and see if he's standing by to tell us all about Real Schalke 6-1, listeners. This is going to be cracking. I wonder what Sid's got to say about this. Sid, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well.
Good.
I'm very well. Tell me a little bit about the reaction to Real Madrid's awesome performance at Schalke.
Well, the reaction has been that it was an awesome performance at Schalke.
Right.
It was. I think there's a real excitement about it for lots of reasons. The fundamental one, obviously, is just the bottom line that it's 6-1, and that's a fantastic result. But there's lots of other factors to build into it. That all three of the front players got two goals each. What they're calling the BBC, of course, Bale, Benzema, and Cristiano. And I think that's important because there've been a few doubts, not so much about Benzema and Cristiano, who've been playing very well, but about Gareth Bale recently, although he scored that brilliant goal at the weekend. I think the fact that Cristiano Ronaldo came back off that three-game ban and played so well was significant. Bear in mind as well that this is, I think, only the second time in 26 games that Real Madrid have won in Germany. And then once the dust settled a little bit on it, there was an extra little layer, if you like, of excitement, because they started to realise that this means that the second leg obviously is done. It's no big deal, and Madrid can rotate, which means they can rotate as they prepare for the Clásico. So there was a sense as well that not only is this brilliant in Champions League, it could actually have a very positive effect for the big, big La Liga game against Barcelona.
Sid, was it Real Madrid's... Was this them coming of age under Ancelotti? Was it just another level of performance to what we've seen before?
Well, I suppose on one level, it kind of was. I think it's the best it's going to play. I thought Schalke were a very strange side, very poor, and they made things, I wouldn't say easy for Real Madrid because it was a brilliant performance, but I think they played into Madrid's hands to some extent. I think there is a sense that this was the best we've seen from Real Madrid, but I think Ancelotti actually probably will take as much satisfaction from some of the other games this season. I personally think Madrid, bit by bit, have started to look very, very strong indeed. Even when they're not playing well, there's a security about them, a dominance of games about them that wasn't there last year. I think the big difference between Madrid over the last couple of years and Madrid this year is they're still a brilliant team when they counter-attack, but that's not the focus of their game now. That's something they use when they need it rather than something they try and play to, which means that they have much, much more of the ball, which, as we've talked about before, it means that they're protected. I mean, having the ball is not just about creating chances, it's about making sure the other side don't get anywhere near you. And recently, it's felt to me like no one has even made Real Madrid struggle. I mean, Casillas made that brilliant save last night, but it was the only save he made. Then when he conceded the incredible goal at the end, that ended a run of 952, I think it is, minutes without conceding. Diego Lopez in La Liga has had a relatively similar run. And in both cases, it's because Madrid have just not allowed their opponents to create any chances against them at all.
Yeah, all right. Anyway, poor old Schalke, they got taken apart by Real Madrid, but at least this weekend they're back in the... Oh, they're taking on Bayern Munich. They're facing Bayern Munich this weekend. Yeah. Rough that for Jens Keller.
I know it's not normally our way on the pod to get into kind of deep tactical analysis.
Oh, yeah.
But I was really struck by the fact that when you saw the front three from Madrid, Bale, Benzema, Ronaldo, it was always those three against the back four. There was never another midfielder between them and the defence. It always felt like they had loads and loads of space. There seemed to be a really big gap between the back four and the midfield. So it was, from Madrid's point of view, it always felt to me like it was a question of if you got the ball through to those three, then those three against four are always going to have a really good chance. And I was impressed by Bale because there have been one or two doubts about him this year, despite his brilliant statistics. And last night was definitely the most involved I've seen him. There's been games when he's been just as decisive, but that was definitely the most involved.
All right, excellent. Now, Real Madrid on a real high then as they return to Liga action this weekend when they face the derby.
Yeah, really, really exciting, isn't it? I mean, bear in mind that last weekend, of course, Atletico Madrid and Barcelona both lost. They slipped 3 points behind Real Madrid. So the hope of it going back to a three-way tie at the top depends on Atletico Madrid beating Real Madrid, which would be important as well, because it's head, and this is another reason why this game matters, it's head-to-head goal difference at the end of the season that matters. So in other words, if Atletico Madrid and Real Madrid finish level, it won't matter that Real Madrid have scored four against Valladolid, say, or five against Elche, or whatever it may be. What will matter is what they've done against each other. Atletico Madrid have the advantage at the moment, 1-0 from the first game. So this is a chance then to play for the 3 points of the game, and also, if you like, play for that little tiebreaker should they finish level with Madrid at the end of the season.
All right, well, Atletico now ended that long derby hoodoo. So can they do it again this weekend, Sid? What's your feeling?
Well, they did end that derby hoodoo, but they also got knocked. They also then lost it again in the sense that they got knocked out by Real Madrid in the Copa del Rey, lost both games, and lost both games. The first game was a real battle and quite entertaining in a dirty sort of way, and the second game was just, I think, basically quite comfortable for Madrid, having got the advantage. But I think what's significant is that Atletico Madrid lost those games because they lost them, because it can happen, not because they fell into that spiral of fatalism that affected them for so long. Can they do it? Yes, they can. I still think Real Madrid are favourites, but I think the difference is that we're not going into this knowing that Atletico Madrid will capitulate, knowing that something ridiculous will go wrong, because it always does. I think we go into this thinking that it's likely to be a properly good game. Well, as I say, I do think that there's been something a little bit off about Atletico Madrid for perhaps 5-6 weeks or so, and Real Madrid are getting stronger and stronger.
All right, Sid. Anything else you want to discuss? For example, Andre Villas-Boas to Barcelona?
Yeah, I just don't really see that.
Really, I mean, Sid?
Maybe,
really?
Maybe, but I just kind of don't. But I mean, in some ways he fits. He fits quite nicely, but I don't know. It's a bit of a laugh, isn't it, that after the Man City game, there was this real sense that, Tata Martino's done it. He's got his signature game now, the game when he got it absolutely right, when he understood what Barcelona were all about, when he completely dominated City, which was by the way, I know people may disagree with that, but that was a perspective in Catalonia anyway. And then 5 days later or 6 days later, they blow up, and they were miserable, by the way. They were awful in San Sebastian. And now everyone says, he's rubbish. He's got to go. And I felt for a while now, and I've been saying this to people, I think I've said it to you, that it kind of feels to me like Barcelona are only two or three bad results away from a crisis because of everything that's happened institutionally, because of, you know, things like the stuff with the tax man and the Neymar signing and so on. I think they're only two or three bad games away from a crisis at some point. And Tata Martino will no doubt be one of the people who pay for that.
Hey, in other continental news, it's a very big weekend. As Sib was just explaining, you've got the derby in Madrid. In France, you've got Le Classique. Oui. Paris Saint-Germain are taking on L'OM, their old and loathed rivals, Olympique Marseille. And it'll be interesting. Ibrahimovic on 22 goals. He's also top of the assist chart in Ligue 1. PSG are 5 points clear of Monaco. Olympique Marseille are 3 points off a Champions League place. They've had a bit of a comeback. And Monaco in second place. A lot of talk that Ranieri is going to be on his way at the end of the year. They're taking on Saint-Etienne. In Saint-Etienne, who are very much Champions League contenders, Les Verts. I've lost you on that one, Barry. So let me try a little bit of Italy, where, boom, it's Milan-Juve. Milan-Juve, Barry. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mid-table Milan.
Well, they're not as... Yeah, they are. But they're actually now, I think, only... they're not that far off a Europa League spot. So some form... Yeah, absolutely. Some form of European football could be forthcoming for the Rossoneri.
Revitalised Adel Tarbert.
Exactly.
He's scoring for fun.
Scoring, he is indeed. Clarence Seedorf. It's all about Clarence Seedorf. And they are taking on a Juventus side, obviously steamrolling pretty much all opposition. But... they will be in the Europa League Thursday night, away in Trabzonspor. So we'll have to see how that whole thing, of course, Turkey, a country with bad memories, recent memories for Juve, how that impacts on this absolutely colossal game. Yes. Tell you what, there is a place you can see that game live and enjoy the action from PSG against L'OM and all the goals from France, Germany and Italy. But modesty prevents me from telling you where that is. Post, hey? If a tree falls in the forest and it doesn't get mentioned on the pod, does it make a sound? That's very much the philosophical theme explored by a couple of posters. Miss Stu, for example, who wants us to mention Aberdeen with another win against Celtic, ending Celtic's unbeaten league record and Forster's clean sheet run. And the gap at the top now, mere 21 points, point out Mr. Stu. Also keen for us to rubber stamp events in the world of football is Kevin Crowe, who says, down in the cupboard under the stairs, in brackets, the conference, Luton... have just gone 14 points clear at the top of the table, winning their last three games 7-0, 5-0 and 5-0 respectively. Any chance of some pod love? That's extraordinary, isn't it?
And the coldest night I've ever had at a football game was at Luton a couple of years ago.
Right.
And they beat Forest Green 7-1 that night.
But there you go. There you go.
Sorry, who's the poster there?
This is Kev Crowe.
Right, but Postman Kev and his fellow Lutonites might be interested to know that there is... a Sean Ingle Luton Town special. Wow. Very much ahoy. I think it might be this Friday or Saturday.
In the Guardian and on the Guardian website.
And because he was telling me yesterday, he was talking to TV's Nick Owen, who is a big noise at Luton and has a suite named after him at Kenilworth Road.
Will Mad Uncle Jimmy be making an appearance in the special or not?
I doubt it.
Okay.
But, yeah. And Sean was saying apparently Nick Owen is one of the... TV personalities on whom Alan Partridge was based.
Well, I
which
can't
I didn't know.
Right, interesting. Anyway, all that Luton business, 14 points clear, incredible results. Here comes Postman Hat, and he points out, we were 11 points behind Cambridge in October. Have there been any bigger turnarounds? That's remarkable, isn't it? They were 11 points behind Cambridge in October. Now, about 4 months later, they're 14 points clear. That's a 25-point swing.
You could almost hear the gears shifting in your head.
The sleeper has awoken, it says.
Do that basic arithmetic.
They're 24 games unbeaten and counting. Luton.
Luton Town, one of the 22 teams to vote for a Premier League breakaway.
Really?
From the Football League. That went well.
When did they... Right. Oh, back then. Right, that's enough on posts. All right, Barry, get your felt tip out as we discuss Fulham-Chelsea.
Yeah, it's a really underwhelming.
No, it's not.
Premier League.
It's
derby.
Top against bottom. How can you not love first against 20th?
Oh no, it is. It's great.
You just called it underwhelming. That's all I'm saying.
No, I meant as derbies go, it's underwhelming. You know, there's this supposed hatred of Chelsea fans and Luton fans, or sorry, Fulham fans. I'm still back in Luton, but it's kind of difficult to imagine Fulham fans hating anybody.
Right. They're the kind of Ian McIntoshes of the Premier League.
Yeah, although I think it was one of the first occasions I was there. There was a guy sitting behind me, and he just spent the entire night shouting abuse at Bobby Zamora, which I thought was a bit mean.
It is a bit mean, isn't it?
Yeah, there was a weird thing that went on there between Zamora and the Fulham fans, where I think there was a kind of a lack of love that went on, and Zamora took it very personally. There was a period where even though he was, I can't remember exactly the details, but I did go and interview him at the time, and he expressed his sadness about how he felt he was getting stick from the home fans.
I don't want to imagine a sad Bobby Zamora.
He was quite sad.
No one wants that.
Of course, this is...
You don't want to imagine a sad anyone.
No, here. That's true.
Much like Man United, not the force they once were at Old Trafford, Fulham perhaps are not the nice guy cottagers that they used to be now that Felix Magath has arrived with his crazy specs and his intense physical regime and his no-nonsense manner.
Have any stories emanated from Fulham Cottage as to what these methods are like, or have any of the players been...
Kind of expecting the head of an underperforming player to be mounted on a spike outside the training ground.
Or used as a medicine ball.
Yeah. Apparently that's one of the theories of how football was invented.
Really, heads?
Yeah, a beheaded Viking prince being used as a ball by Anglo-Saxon warriors, no less.
And it caught on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, why wouldn't it? Could you do anything more fun in the countryside?
Is that really a theory?
It is. Okay. One of many, it must be said.
And now, many hundreds of years later, we arrive at Fulham-Chelsea. Fulham, for their part, haven't won a game in 7, but this will be the debut of Felix Magath at Craven Cottage. Chelsea coming off this 1-1 draw away at Galatasaray.
Yeah, look, there's 39 points between them. It's tricky to...
They don't have a striker, Chelsea.
Well, Fernando Torres put one away fairly confidently, didn't he? Right.
Nobody wants to play on this one. You're all saying Chelsea, aren't you?
You're trying really hard, James.
I don't know.
Chelsea did have a very underwhelming... If you want to make a case for Fulham, Chelsea had a very underwhelming win against Everton last week. They were very lucky to win, I think, and could easily have lost. So if they were to carry that form through... And who knows, you know, and Fulham's players can muster enough energy after their 25-mile cross-country run before the match to put half a performance together. Yeah, maybe they could beat them.
Do you know that Fulham have named more different players to matchday squads than any other team in the Premier League? They've named 40 different players in the matchday 18.
That's interesting.
And the starting 11 is likely to have 5 or 6 players who hadn't played since before January.
Right. Well, of course, a lot of that is fruit of the fact that they're on their third manager of the season.
Yes, with a number of loanees, permanent transfers, people coming in out of the youth team. It's not really a surprise that they haven't managed to put together any kind of consistent run.
Well, as has been pointed out, it's all happened since they got rid of the statue of Michael Jackson.
Oh, God, yeah.
Things have fallen apart. You may feel I'm taking too long, devoting too much time to Fulham and Chelsea, but it's only because I've seen the other games that are coming up this weekend. Spurs-Cardiff, talking point. Will Solskjaer make it to the end of the season? Amy?
Probably.
Do you think he will? If you can fire the... Well, I suppose there might have been other factors for the Marky Mackay dismissal, but Solskjaer, in terms of keeping the club up...
Yeah, but, I mean, what are you going to do now?
Don't know.
It just seems really odd to just be firing people.
What about West Brom then? They've already got Pepe Mel.
What's going on there?
Discussions about Pepe Mel. He's been there, was it 6 games, is it? Not one.
No.
So, and the players are not happy about his tactics. Richard Garlick is... I just mentioned his name because it's funny enough.
Well, Richard Garlick's predecessor, since he's gone to the FA, it's all sort of gone wrong at West Brom. And... My pal, who's a fan of theirs, he thinks that it's no coincidence. Dan Ashworth went to work for the FA. It's no coincidence that it's all gone wrong at the Hawthorns, and he's sort of sad that after some years of stability, they now are going to go back to being what he described as a clown car collapsing in the circus ring. But he is kind of wearily resigned to it.
But they spent so long finding Pepe Mel? I mean, isn't that the curiosity of it? They had such quite a, you know,
I don't understand
while they were trying to figure out who it was who was going to.
I don't understand why, because this isn't a slight against Pepe Mel, who did very, very well with Betis before half his team was sold from under his feet. But they've in the past, West Brom have made a point of being consistent and laying down plans, even to the point they would, instead of selling players, they would loan them for a season with the fee arranged so that they could get the money in and use it against tax so that it made the transfer more efficient. They were that kind of meticulous club. And now to have a squad which is built for counter-attacking football and suddenly bring in a high-line pressing manager that none of the players are comfortable with, who doesn't know the Premier League, it's really bizarre.
And then to air in the papers the fact that you've now got said manager under discussion because none of the players are happy with them.
The vote of confidence with no vote of confidence.
Mm. Well, they don't have a game this weekend because they would have been playing Sunderland. So we'll see where they are after everybody else has played their matches. Cardiff, we mentioned the fact that they're at Spurs, and is anyone optimistic about their chances there against Tottenham?
Yeah, that would be a bit.
Why?
Well, I think Spurs were so poor against Norwich that for all his enthusiasm, it is becoming increasingly clear that Tim Sherwood isn't really equipped to manage in the Premier League, I think. And then again, for all his enthusiasm, it's also becoming apparent that maybe Ole Gunnar Solskjaer isn't either. But I'd certainly give Cardiff a chance of winning that, yeah.
What about Swansea Palace?
Well, they're coming in off the UEFA Cup tie with Europa League Cup tie.
Right,
sorry,
that's true. So we can't
Napoli.
Really talk too much about what Swansea are going to be, kind of shape they're going to be. Palace, though?
Well, Palace have been great every time I've seen them since Pulis came in. I'm playing fast and loose with the word great, obviously, but much better than they were before Pulis was in there. I'll back them.
But they're only 2 points off the bottom three, so they are by no means out of danger. Palace, Stoke, another team who could find themselves sucked into that whole bottom three scenario. They are hosting Arsenal, who, Amy, you'll know this, they haven't won in the last three visits to the Britannia, the Gunners.
Is that so?
Oh, you won't know that then. Yeah, it is. It is true. It is true. And hey, Robert Huth's back available.
Okay.
Right.
I think Arsenal have a few defensive issues with some players that have injury concerns. But Mesut Ozil, as you mentioned him earlier, James, will be back from his rest.
He will, yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see if he's selected or not.
Amy, one thing we never talked about, were you aware of Joel Campbell?
I was aware of Joel Campbell. Yeah. I was aware of him because there was a period, a particularly dignified period for Arsenal, where they lost 8-2 to Manchester United a few years ago. And I think that was coincided with a time when Fabregas and Nasri, having made their intentions clear throughout the summer, one of those sagas finally left. It all came together at the same time. Arsenal were looking completely desperate, and their transfer hotshot negotiator Dick Law spent at least a full week out in Costa Rica at a time when Arsenal were desperately trying to sort out their revamping their squad a little bit, trying to find the right man to speak to about Joel Campbell, who, it then turned out, when he finally did find the right man, didn't qualify for a work permit anyway.
Right.
So it was really good efficient use of Arsenal's time at that point. Anyway, he arrived, but couldn't play because he didn't have a work permit. And I'm not sure how this work permit thing goes, actually, when you're bringing in players from outside the EU, and they can apply for this special case situation with certain players. And Arsenal got those for Rio Miyachi from Japan, but that doesn't seem to have quite justified it. And Danielson also was someone who was granted a special work permit.
Isn't it decided by committee?
But why do they, on what basis they say, yeah, you can come in, but you can't. Anyway, Joel Campbell couldn't, and he went off on loan, first of all, to the French League for a few months. That didn't go terribly well. He then had another loan in Spain, and finally got this loan with Olympiacos. So it didn't really look like things were, while he was over there, you could dress it up by saying, here's a guy who's hanging out in Europe on loan trying to get his work permit, but also wanted him to develop, or whether it was just he was being sent out on loan because he wasn't ever going to cut the mustard. And he scored a rather lively goal against Man United.
He certainly did. Will it be him and Van Persie lining up for Arsenal up front next season, do you think? Is that why Arsenal didn't buy anyone in January? You can tell us.
Well, it could be him and Yaya Sanogo.
Ooh.
There's all sorts of possibilities.
All three.
Did you see your old friend Emmanuel Abue playing for Galatasaray?
I did.
He did quite well, I thought.
Loads of memories.
Gary Neville, who was doing the match analysis for Sky, did a very amusing, utter character assassination on Abua mid-game. Just, you know, obviously, he's never where you want him to be. And he was speaking, you know, if you're on his team, as not never where you want to be, in a good way. And, then just sort of went off on this riff about how rubbish he was.
Do you know, Emmanuel Abue is the reason I've been blacklisted by Arsenal TV. I'm not allowed on Arsenal TV at all.
Why is that?
Because about 5 years ago, I went on as a last-minute replacement for someone, misread my role in the proceedings, and when asked about Abue, I said that he was a disgrace to himself and to his club. And the studio went very, very quiet, and I've never been asked back.
Right. Mm. There you go.
What had he done to incur the Macintosh wrath?
I think I've been sent off twice in 7 days, and one of them was against Tottenham very early on for an act of gross stupidity.
How about that? Now, Stoke Arsenal, yeah, just a point off the top of the table, you're going to, yeah?
Well, I mean, it's that classic Wenger thing where he's in the middle of three competitions all coming at him at the same time, and how to best juggle the resources.
Right.
Because, you know, this is the one that obviously people will be expecting them to just go and do a job and come home but safely with the points. But if they're too casual about it, it isn't going to necessarily work out that well. And for me, the most important game for Arsenal coming up in this little period is Everton in the FA Cup, which is next weekend after next.
Right. Here's three games we haven't mentioned. Hull, Newcastle. Hull have been looking very impressive of late because they, you know, brought in Long and Jelovic. And Everton, West Ham. Potential there for West Ham to go 5 wins in a row against an Everton team who, Ian, you reckon have been unlucky of late.
Yeah, very much so. Against Tottenham, they had the better of it, let themselves down with one lapse in concentration. And at Chelsea, they were obviously horrifically compromised by losing their striker five minutes before the start of the game.
Right, well, West Ham know all about losing their striker, don't they?
Certainly
they
do.
Could have Andy Carroll back, and what a tandem that would be with a Kevin Nolan, who scored 5 goals in his last 4.
And yet so harsh on Carlton Cole. It's been a machine.
There's winners and there's losers in this game we call football. The game we haven't talked about is Villa-Norwich. Hey, there's a little bit of business there, isn't there, Lambert?
Norwich won't even talk to Aston Villa about anything.
Well, they're not.
Broken off all diplomatic communication. Well, they haven't broken off all diplomatic communications. They'll still pick up the phone to go, bugger off! Right. But that's about it.
So being ignored by Norwich.
Ugh.
You know. So.
Hasn't stopped them wanting half of their players, though.
Yeah, I suppose it's you know.
Maybe it's just egging them on. They want it more because they can't have it.
Yeah, exactly.
Mind games. Yeah. Mind games. All right, well, that is a fitting note, he said. You get to leave. On which to finish today's Football Weekly Extra. Many thanks for being with us today, listener. And you, Amy Lawrence, Barry Glendinning and Ian McIntosh. We'll be back on Monday. As ever, there's a paper review available on Friday, looking at European reactions to the Champions League. Plenty of Greek stuff in that. And I hope you have a super weekend until we speak to you next. Bye-bye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.